Coming up on The Exchange, state lawmakers debate all night and pass a bill that effectively guts collective bargaining for public workers in Iowa.
This is bad public policy. It's bad public policy to blame the workers who sometimes put their lives on the line for our communities and make incredible sacrifices instead of really putting the blame where it belongs.
Also, we get a preview of the Sioux City Film Festival with some teenagers from North High School who created a short film about the legacy of Martin Luther King Jr.
Dr. Martin Luther King's message is still relevant today, not only towards African Americans, but other groups.
That and more coming up on The Exchange. Welcome to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. The American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees Union is suing the state in reaction to passage last week of House File 291. The bill basically ended most collective bargaining for teachers and other public employees in Iowa. Lawmakers debated the bill all through the night last week with some emotional pleas from House and Senate Democrats.
These are real people being implicated by a real policy. And what we are doing is we are compromising their futures.
Public employees deserve our respect and our support. They do not deserve House File 291.
Iowans know this is extreme. That's why they're turning out in record numbers to forums, hoping to be listened to by their elected officials, even though that has yet to happen.
See these working families that you're attacking today? They are my friends, they are my neighbors, and they are my family. And they are your neighbors.
Lawmakers passed the bill Thursday. Governor Terry Branstad signed it Friday. Speaking from Des Moines right after the passage of the bill, Sioux City State Democratic Representative Chris Hall said the effects of it were already showing.
So right now you see many cities, counties, and school boards working to quickly ratify contracts with their unions because they truly want to support their workers and give them some stability moving forward over the next year or two. I cannot say thank you and commend highly enough the local governments that are choosing to do so, and Sioux City deserves credit for doing that in the last week. Once the bill is signed into law, it will immediately remove protective provisions that have been in place for more than 40 years to give workers a say about their health care, retirement, vacation, and other important terms of what their employment looks and feels like. They will have fewer protections than they have for the past 40 years. There will be significant changes to the way that employees are treated under state law. And it also continues to prevent them from the ability to have a say in what their workplace safety and employment conditions will look like.
And I suppose, really, there's nothing that can be changed about this. Is there any way to ever get back to that from here, to the place where they were before?
It's very difficult to tell what will happen in future years. What is most unfortunate is the fact that this bill removes law that was originally signed in by a bipartisan compromise, including a Republican governor, and it has worked relatively well over the past 40 years. There might be a reasonable person could say that there are ways that the law could have been improved, but no consideration was given to the people affected by the law. No consideration was given to the minority party in either the House or Senate. And this bill was kept under secret lock and key until this week and rushed through the legislature in order to try and quell any dissent or input. This is a bill that was heavily influenced by out-of-state corporations, the Koch brothers, Dark Money in particular, Americans for Prosperity, and outside groups that have no interest in Iowa other than to further erode workplace safety conditions and also to erode the capacity of government to do well by its citizens.
Well, is there anything else you wanted to say about it before I let you go?
The only final remark I'll make is that it is truly a sad day in Iowa. I think reasonable people from both Republican, Democratic, and independent backgrounds could all say, why wouldn't we want to compromise? Why wouldn't we want to look at ways to improve the law if it isn't functioning? That is not what has happened. There was no compromise. There was no bipartisanship in this effort. This is a train wreck moving forward and something that will affect 184,000 Iowans in the worst way possible.
That was Sioux City Democratic Representative Chris Hall. Republican John Wills of Denison has the opposite opinion of House File 291. He talks about the reasons behind the collective bargaining bill and answers some of the concerns raised by Democrats.
The original bill was done in the 1970s, and, you know, of course, a lot of things has changed in the state since the 1970s, and so, you know, there's just needed to be some updates done to it. You know, back in the 70s, we didn't have, you know, such things as laws against harassment or you know, that sort of thing, and now we do, so there was some reason to change for that, but also, the bill really takes a lot of local control away from local boards and cities and councils, and so we wanted to return some of that power, some of that control back to the local board members, which in a sense returns power back to the taxpayer because those bodies are elected very locally and that sort of thing. So we really saw a need to return some power back to the taxpayer through their local school boards, city councils, and supervisors.
One of the things on here that seemed important to a lot of Republicans about taxpayers not being, you know, the quote-unquote collection agent for government unions.
Why does the county or the state or the school board have to take union dues out of their employees' paycheck? You know, there's a lot of easy ways for union members to do that on their own just by simply going to their bank and having an electronic withdrawal from their account. You know, back in the 70s, that was one of the things that, you know, probably was a good thing. They probably didn't have any good way to do that sort of thing. And today, with our modern era of banks and electronic withdrawals and that sort of thing, it really doesn't make any sense for the state to pay for that or do that.
When it comes to collective bargaining, what are some things that this bill would prohibit?
The things that would be prohibited are such things as vacation, grievance procedures, seniority, release time, that sort of thing. Just kind of things that a boss or a supervisor would really like to have as tools in which to reward or to punish an employee.
There was also a lot of confusion about this idea of firing someone for cause.
Back in the 70s, we didn't have anti-discrimination laws or anything like that. And so back in the 70s, they put this phrase in there that basically said you couldn't be fired except for just cause. And so we just said, hey, we don't need that anymore because this is the modern era. And it scared a lot of people. And so we listened to the taxpayers of Iowa. We listened to the employees of our governmental agencies and our school teachers and said, hey, you know, it doesn't make that big of a difference to just leave that in there. So we put it back in just because it left a lot of fear and made people think that they could be fired just because. And that's absolutely not true. That's not what we wanted. And it did little to change the bill as it was anyway. So that kind of, you know, is an unintended consequence of doing something and trying to do the right thing.
I've read a lot and heard a lot from teachers about their worries about this bill and their, you know, livelihood and their careers. Do you think they have a point?
I believe, you know, change, anytime change happens, people get worried and really humans are strange critters that we don't like change. We just like everything to be the same. And so I really do believe that this bill is going to make local innovation, local county supervisors and city councils and school boards be innovative with what they do. They have more flexibility. And I believe that's going to be and fit school teachers' lives better instead of having the same old cookie cutter thing that the state dictates.
That was John Wills, Republican State House Representative from Denison, talking about the collective bargaining bill signed by Governor Branstad last week. Many Iowa Democratic lawmakers have compared House File 291 with Act 10, passed by Wisconsin legislators in 2011. That law also gutted collective bargaining and changed the way teachers were hired, promoted, paid, and fired. Dave Umfier is a journalist with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He says union membership decreased after the passage of Act 10 and culture shock set in.
Teachers had regular across-the-board raises and all their benefits locked in under collective bargaining. And now it's kind of a free-for-all. Teachers are moving around from district to district in hopes of getting higher pay. They are seeing pay for performance plans come in routinely now, where seniority doesn't make as much difference. Tenure with the district doesn't seem to matter nearly as much anymore. Performance is a bigger factor, and it's just a massive, massive change.
How has this affected school districts, you know, especially smaller school districts compared to bigger ones like Madison or Milwaukee?
Rural school districts and districts that are not as financially well off have suffered more under Act 10 because they are not able to keep up with the competition. Now you see bidding wars breaking out for teachers, which is a whole new thing. And for districts that have increasing enrollment or are getting more state aid, and we're in a good situation, they are poaching teachers routinely from other districts. And there's some hard feelings, and what used to be a kind of a collegial cooperative atmosphere in education in some respects has become more of a free market, free agency model with all that implies.
Do you think that taxpayers thought that teachers and other public sector workers were on a sort of a gravy train for a long time?
I think some here would say that they were kind of brought more into line with the rest of society. Teachers would say that, hey, why can't everybody have what we have?
So is there an upside to this?
Sure. You know, younger teachers especially look at this much differently. I'm generalizing, but that seems to be the case, where they weren't brought up in collective bargaining. They don't know exactly what the merits of that were. And they see more freedom, perhaps, to negotiate individually. Some are getting, you know, $5,000, $10,000 raises just to move to another school district. So they don't see as big a deal here. Districts as well have gotten a lot of budget savings. Act 10 mandated that employees pay into their pension plan, and it allowed districts to charge a lot more for health insurance to their employees, and in some cases schedule teachers to work more often.
Do you think Iowa teachers and unions will have some of the same problems that Wisconsin has already had?
If the impact in Iowa is like we saw in Wisconsin, you can expect to see far-ranging effects. But I think it'll probably be somewhat in slow motion because you have, like we did, so many school districts have extended their contracts or rushed to negotiate contracts that will put off the effects of this for several years.
There have been people here who have been predicting teachers will leave districts, will leave Iowa to find other teaching jobs. Have you seen that happen in Wisconsin?
Along the border with Minnesota, we've seen some increase in that. It's fairly anecdotal. It's hard to pin down the numbers. But Minnesota pays teachers quite a bit more than Wisconsin. So you're starting to see some border wars break out like that, and I wouldn't be surprised to see some of that as well.
That was reporter Dave Umfier, who works for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He spent many years covering Wisconsin government and politics. Umfier says there have been some instances of Wisconsin teachers crossing over into Minnesota since the passage of Act 10. They're looking for better pay and better jobs. School Superintendent Joe Brown of Fairmount Public School District in southern Minnesota, just over the border from Iowa, is seeing the same thing. Brown is a former Iowa legislator. He wrote a letter to Iowa lawmakers warning them about the damage the collective bargaining bill could do to schools and teachers. And now he's already interviewing teachers from Iowa.
these letters are pretty consistent. I mean, number one, they just don't feel like they're being appreciated. You know, teachers work hard. One of my six children is a English teacher in Mankato. She is in her 10th year. My wife is a teacher, high school teacher over in Austin, Minnesota. I used to be a teacher myself years ago before I went into politics. But the bottom line is I know how hard the vast majority of teachers work. And it's not just 9 months out of the year. They work year-round. They work on Saturdays. They work on Sundays. I'm actually in my office today. We have President's Day off. We don't have any children here, but there are teachers here working in my building. They're not required to be here, but they're working. They're getting ready for the next week. And teachers work very hard. And once a teacher feels like they're not appreciated, they do one of two things. Either they quit teaching altogether, or they simply go to another district. And to make a move from Iowa to Minnesota, you know, you're giving up a lot. First of all, you're going to get paid more by coming to Minnesota because we pay higher salaries than Iowa does. But you're also giving up your retirement. And so you have to start your retirement all over again. You're going from IPER's retirement in Iowa into our teacher's retirement annuity here in Minnesota, which is also a very good retirement system. But to think that someone's going to either give up their house, you know, bring their children here, it's consistently, they just don't feel like they're being appreciated. And they feel like they've just been slapped in the face. And so that's the commonality of these letters I've received, emails. And as soon as I receive an email, we send them an electronic application, and they've actually filled them out and sent them back already. I'm actually reviewing some of them today already. And we've got some outstanding teachers. Some of these people look like they're just superstars. And so the best and the brightest will go. And that's what really concerns me the most. And that's what really prompted me to write the letter to begin with. I knew that this piece of legislation was on a fast track, and I understand that. I'm a former legislator. I understand how things happen. But really, here's what really saddens me. I can find no evidence at all, looking at last year's November election, that any single legislator ran on the campaign that they were going to dismantle Chapter 20 of the Iowa Code. This has been a law that has been in place since 1974 when Republican Governor Robert D. Ray signed that law into legislation.
Do you think people are especially concerned, teachers and administrators are concerned, especially in rural areas where it's hard to get teachers?
It's going to be tough. What the Republican legislature just did, they did not know this, but they're going to force consolidation. They're going to force school consolidation. And they probably would never say that they would ever vote for that, but that's going to be the net result. Because when you lack teachers, and what happened in Wisconsin, their shortage of teachers is so bad that they've had to assign teachers to teach all day long without preparations. They've had to assign teachers to teach outside of their field of study, and they're having a heck of a time. And, you know, once a legislature makes a decision like that, the only time it's ever going to change is if there's another election. And unfortunately, the next election is 21 months away. And within 21 months, my prediction is, you know, not there's going to be a lot of change this September when people start looking for jobs and start looking for teachers. But a year from now, right before these legislators have to run for reelection, they're going to be shocked at the number of faculty members that their local schools do not have, because these people are going to vote with their feet. I mean, if you can come to a state that pays you $10,000 to $15,000 more per year, that provides you quality health care through Blue Cross Blue Shield, and of course most of our faculty have access to the Mayo Clinic here in southern Minnesota, and you have job security, then you're going to come here. You're going to leave your home state.
That was former Iowa lawmaker and school superintendent Joe Brown of Fairmont Public School District in Minnesota, just over the Iowa border. He says he hopes to hire some Iowa teachers in the near future. You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett.
The Sioux City International Film Festival begins today. The lineup includes feature-length films, short films, documentaries, and more. Students at North High School have created a film called A New Tomorrow Begins Today, about the legacy of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. It will be screened tonight and tomorrow at the Stony Creek Hotel. Here's a clip from the film.
I grew up in South Dakota in the 1970s, and at that time it was more different than you guys can probably even imagine, because people didn't even want to use the word. It was so revolting and disgusting. And the only time you used the word that what we use as gay now, it would be if you called somebody a fag because you wanted to make fun of them.
Producers Keenan Najdawi and Camden Beller say the film is really about being tolerant.
The message that we wanted was that we wanted to show how Dr. Martin Luther King's message is still relevant today, not only towards African Americans, but other groups. So, like, we interviewed someone who's transgender, someone who's gay. We interviewed an interracial couple, a Muslim man. People that you wouldn't normally think of when you think of Dr. Martin Luther King's message, but to show that it still applies to them as well.
Were you surprised by any of the things that the people said?
Oh, yeah. We were surprised when we were doing the interviews. So, I mean, we'd want to get that message out to other people, too, because, like he said, we wanted to get the message out to not just people for the MLK's message, not just for African-Americans, but to all kinds of different people.
There was, one specific example that just pops out to me is when we were talking to Jim Sorvag, who was the gay man that we interviewed, and he was talking about the adoption process, and it was, ridiculous. There's, a hierarchy of whom they give the kids to and, what babies that they will be able to receive, and, he was saying that homosexual couples are, the bottom of the bottom list.
And he's not saying that they only judge these people that are trying to adopt, like the gays. They're not only judging them different, they're judging these babies too. They're putting these special needs kids with the gays, they're lower, just like the gays are lower. So, we thought that was really crazy that they did stuff like that.
Do you think your generation is a little more accepting to alternative lifestyles?
I would think so, yeah. I think older generations haven't experienced that. They haven't been surrounded by it as much as we have, but I think in the last decade or so, it's really started to, more groups have started to emerge. And so we've gotten to see that, we've gotten to live with it, be surrounded with it, and accept it as, normal and not something different and crazy. And I'm not saying everyone who's older is thinking that, but I think it's just easier for our generation to accept that.
Do you guys want to continue to work? Do you want to make some more projects, media projects?
We'll be doing this for the rest of the year, but next year I plan to go to Iowa and major in cinema, so I'm planning on doing this for a living. So,
for me, it's just more learning the knowledge of, setting up interviews and just having this available to me, just knowing how to do it, but I'm actually going, I'm not sure what I'm majoring, but I'll be on a pre-med track, so. But it'll just be good to know, how to do all this stuff.
Keenan Najdawi and Cameron Beller are seniors at Sioux City's North High School. They produce the film A New Day Begins Tomorrow about the enduring effects of the work of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. The film will be screened tonight and tomorrow at the Stony Creek Hotel as part of the Sioux City International Film Festival. The festival runs through Sunday. Martin Luther King Jr. was a pivotal leader in the civil rights era when increasing numbers of African American students were attending the University of Iowa. But black students were at the school as early as the 1930s. Their stories are featured in the book Invisible Hawkeyes, African Americans at the University of Iowa During the Long Civil Rights Era.
UI Associate Professor of English and African American Studies Lena Hill is one of the editors of the book. Hill says African Americans were coming to the University of Iowa as early as the 1930s.
Given the time, right, in 1930, out of about 10,000 students, you had around 1994 African American students. In 1940, around 11,000 students, total 200 African American students. So people will often ask us, you know, well, what brought African American students to the University of Iowa? And even in a larger way, how did they know about the University of Iowa? And that is one of the interesting discoveries that we made in the book, is that at a time when many segregated states were dealing with lawsuits from the NAACP that were saying, hey, you're not living up to separate but equal. You're not providing equal opportunities for African American students to seek particularly advanced degrees and professional degrees, because there aren't Black schools. There aren't, you know, historically Black colleges and universities for these students to attend in these segregated states. Well, a lot of these states decided to respond not by changing their policy of segregation, but by giving Black students money for them to seek education in other states that would allow them to pursue their degrees. And Iowa was one of those states. So then by word of mouth, by what we call the pipeline between HBCUs and Iowa, you gained momentum as far as Black students telling each other, this is a place that you can go. And more importantly, Black professors really encouraging their students to try out the University of Iowa.
These students would go to the University of Iowa, work a lot with a bunch of different people maybe they never would have met, graduate, and they would take that back to the HBCUs, mm-hmm. take back their knowledge.
They took this training in cutting-edge education at the time, and many of them could have done different things, but they really wanted to go back to HBCUs and take that knowledge so that they could, you know, pass it on to the next generation of African-American educators. And that really did happen.
One of the people you talk about in the book, her name is Elizabeth Catlett, and I had heard that name but not known that much about her. She became a very, very skilled sculptor, artist, and she got to work with some very famous people in the art world.
The wonderful story of Catlett doing her undergraduate work at Howard and working with, you know, really important people there, actually applying to a white school, to Carnegie in Pittsburgh, and being awarded both a scholarship and being admitted until, right, that opportunity was taken away when the institution realized she was Black. So she'd had an experience with applying to a majority white institution and not being invited to go. So when she came to Iowa, she realized it was a great opportunity to work with Grant Wood. And he really was her major mentor and had a profound impact on her own development as a sculptor. But one of the things that we also really try to bring out in the book, and I think Catlett is a wonderful example, is the collaborative nature of the ways that these Black students worked with these leading figures in the field. And Catlett came here in 1938. Grant Wood had painted American Gothic in 1930. So this really was, you know, the height of Grant Wood's own sort of reputation in the world of art. So Catlett worked with him, and she was innovative. She not only sculpted, but worked in graphic mediums. She's just had a wonderful career, and one of the other really nice intersections is she produced the sculpture Invisible Man. That was, you know, one of her last public pieces.
I also was interested in the fact that Fannie McConnell, who became one of Ralph Ellison's wives in the future, was in the theater program.
As the founder of the Negro People's Theater, she produced Langston Hughes' Don't You Want to Be Free and met with Langston Hughes. So this is someone who had her own career, who had her own impact on theater and on Black theater in particular. And it's very important for us to remember that she received a good deal of her training here. Although she came here from Fisk, and at Fisk as an undergraduate student, she was working with James Weldon Johnson, who was one of the dons of the Harlem Renaissance.
What were some of the challenges that some of these folks had, especially in the early years, in terms of segregation and racism?
They had quite a few challenges. Before 1945, they could not live in dormitories. So a major challenge as far as thriving as a student was the fact that when you came here, you had to figure out where you were going to live. Black students really supported each other. They would often find out when a new student was coming on campus. They would meet those students at the train station, and they would go around town with them to try to find a space. And this is even for athletes. Some coaches would meet, you know, athletes who were coming in, and they would have to take them around to different either fraternity houses. There were a few families that are very well known, the Tates, the Lemmings, the Fergusons. These families regularly housed African-American students, so that was a major challenge. Even after the dormitories were desegregated, you know, they had the consistent challenge of even where could they get their hair cut? Where could they get their hair done? Where could they grab a bite to eat for lunch? Where could they hold a social? We were talking the other day, they weren't allowed to hold social events, you know, on campus, many of these African-American students, but churches, local churches would open their basement and let these students have activities. So, you know, beyond the sort of day-to-day existence, they also faced discrimination in their classes, where students didn't always want to work with them. Work beside them.
What I found interesting in the book, and you showed how the students contributed so much to the national and international reputation of the University of Iowa.
Exactly. I mean, we just lost Al Jarreau last week, and many people don't realize that he did his master's work here. But we have so many figures. Ted Wheeler, right, a track star who went on to perform in the Olympics. Catlett, Margaret Walker. Right? I mean, Margaret Walker is a huge figure when you think of literature and all that she goes on to accomplish, doing both a master's and then returning here to do PhD work. These are very important names when you think about different fields and how these students really contributed in important ways to what was an emerging reputation, not an established reputation, an emerging reputation of the University of Iowa as a space that was at the forefront of the art.
Lena Hill is one of the editors of the book, Invisible Hawkeyes, African Americans at the University of Iowa During the Long Civil Rights Era. You're listening to The Exchange here on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. Orange City Arts presents a night of live storytelling featuring Kevin Kling. The show is at 7:30 p.m. Friday at Trinity Reformed Church. Siouxland Public Media's Allie Carson has more.
Kevin Kling is a master storyteller and down-home philosopher from the land of 10,000 lakes. He takes on a serious tone quickly cracked by humor, and while you're softened by laughter, that's when he'll go straight for the heart and pull those strings like a puppet master. He was born with a shortened left arm, missing his thumb and wrist. His grandma always called his disability a gift, and that informed the way he saw the world. It made him special. It made him who he was. But then, in his early 40s, he lost the use of his right arm in a deadly motorcycle crash. That forced him to become a different person and take a hard look at loss.
When we lose something, we grieve, and you grieve only as much as you loved something.
Kling is fluent in inspirational sayings and positive affirmations. His plucky, can-do spirit almost makes you wish for affliction, if only you could be guaranteed that you'd come out the other side a better person, sounding something like the optimistic storyteller himself. How did you become a humorist, or why did you lean on humor to communicate your experiences?
Well, humor really connects us. And as a storyteller, you really need people to trust and to go into your story with an open heart. And one of the things that humor does is it's a connector. Some people think that humor is universal. Well, it really isn't. Humor really relies on family, on faith, on community. And so when you tell something and everyone in the room laughs, we're immediately family. We're immediately connected. And that's really important in telling stories. And it also opens the heart. Like a stand-up comedian will close the door with a joke. But when you're a storyteller, you really open the door with a joke. Then you can get into other stuff. But it's a really way to get us all in the room together as family. My brother and I were learning how to ski, and we were on a rope tow that pulls you to the top of the hill, and then we would slide down, and there was a big sign at the bottom of the hill that said, no long hats, long scarves, or woolly mittens on the rope tow. And, of course, my brother and I are standing there in our long hats, long scarves, and woolly mittens. You know, they don't mean us. And I grabbed onto the rope tow, and when I got to the top, I found out why that sign was there, because the rope twists as it goes up the hill. And my woolly mittens twisted into the rope. And so they became part of the rope tow, and I got to the top, and I couldn't let go. And I got my right arm free, but my left arm wouldn't pull free. And I wear this brace that covers my arm. It's like a cast that I've worn my whole life. So I just let go of my brace, and my brace goes flying through the air. And the woman behind me sees my brace flying through the air, and she says, oh, my gosh, it's his arm, and she's down, and people are piling into her. So my brother and I did the rope tow trick the rest of the day. That's all we did.
You are featured in a PBS documentary called Kevin Kling, Lost and Found. In that, you talk about the power of storytelling and what it means to release a story. You said as soon as you can tell it, you've already taken a step away from it and are looking back at it, which means you've started to control something that used to control you. What have been some of the losses in your life, and how have you come to understand loss?
Well, I think, you know, to be human is really to experience loss. And the longer I'm around, I realize that almost all forms of loss go through the same series of healing. When you can tell a story about something, again, it's that you've already taken a step to control something that's greater than yourself. And I think that loss and story and grief go hand in hand, and humor as well. It's like when you can laugh at something, it doesn't control you any longer. Stories are really important in terms of healing, and our stories ask our biggest questions, you know, where do we come from before life and where do we go after life and what's funny in this world, what's sacred, and what, you know, what's edible. And then when we ask, even if we don't find the answer, we know we belong. We know we're family in these questions. We know we're family in these mysteries that we share together. And part of those mysteries are loss, how we heal from things that aren't with us any longer. And that can be a person or, a limb, like I lost the use of a limb. I think stories are really important in terms of our narrative and how we heal. And one thing I heard a long time ago is the definition of resiliency is maintaining one's shape. And how do you maintain that shape when it's been compromised? And a lot of it is through our stories. We maintain our shape through our stories.
Well, I wanted to talk to you a little bit about storytelling and healing, because I'm actually the founder of a live storytelling series here in Sioux City.
Hey, fantastic.
So I was really excited to talk to you. I've described what we do as this theater meets therapy type of journalistic entertainment.
Oh, what? I love it. That's it. That's good.
Why does storytelling seem to have such a therapeutic quality to it? And how is sharing your story on stage different than releasing your thoughts into a journal or diary that only you read?
They've done studies on people where they hook up sensors to the brain. And when you read a story, knowledge is transferred. But when you hear a story and someone tells a story, the actual experience is transferred. In other words, those parts of your brain that light up when you throw a ball light up when someone talks about throwing a ball. And so there's something that happens in a room with a storyteller, with an actual person, that really transfers the experience. One of my favorite definitions of a storyteller is by Nabokov, the writer, and he says, a storyteller should entertain, educate, and enchant. And I love the last word. I love the idea of enchanting, because it's that thing that happens in the room that you can't quite describe, that is that magic of storytelling, that magic of being in the room with a person. We all remember it as a kid, you know, where somebody came in and just, we were transported, you know, and there's a lot to be said for that.
That's something I still struggle with, to tell people why they should come to our live storytelling events. I just say, you know, okay, so people stand on stage and they tell the true stories about their lives, and it's wonderful. I don't know how to put it into words, the magic that happens there.
Well, it is hard to put into words. I completely agree with you, because I try to explain to people what I do as well, and I say, you just have to go. And once they go, they go, why didn't I know about this? And I said, yeah, you just have to go. You can't believe what happens in the room. Once you go back, you know, because you know what it is.
Mm-hmm. It's so much of a feeling that you get.
It's a feeling of community. It's a feeling feeling of belonging, you know, that we're all in this together. It's a very social activity. It feels great to belong.
You'll also be leading a storytelling workshop while you're in Orange City. In doing work with that, what do you notice about people? Why do they need help telling their stories, or what keeps them from telling their stories?
Well, a lot of times it's just giving people permission, and I don't think people know that they're, you know, you're an expert at your own life. I have to say, I would rather hear a story than tell one. When I'm in a workshop, it's just amazing what happens when people tell stories. Everyone is an expert. It should be really easy, and it should be really fun. The key to storytelling is enjoying yourself.
Going back to you, now that you've said you don't really like to tell your story.
I love telling stories. I just love hearing stories.
I'm sure you get asked a lot about being born with a disabled left arm and then losing the use of your right arm in that motorcycle accident. Do you ever get tired of telling certain stories from your life, or do you find it empowering to find a new audience for these tales?
I do always wonder, is it going to be too much? Part of the secret of storytelling is that it has to really live in the moment. The story has to be the right story for the right moment. And when you tell the story, it has to come to life just as if it's the first time. And besides, every time I tell a story, I learn something else. Something else jumps to the surface. And I think you touched on it with the question, is that a lot of that has to do with the audience. When you're telling a story, you're meeting people halfway. And what does this audience bring to this story that I've never realized before? Because storytelling, when it's done right, is more like a conversation.
I've been talking to Kevin Kling. He will be performing in Orange City at 7:30 p.m. Friday at Trinity Reformed Church. He'll also do a storytelling workshop called Chicken Soup for the Chicken, the Healing Power of Story, at the Old Factory Coffee Shop at 10 a.m. Saturday. Tickets are available at orangecityarts.net. For Siouxland Public Media, I'm Allie Carson.
Listening to The Exchange, I'm Mary Hartnett. And finally today, we'll hear from Ultraviolet, Siouxland Public Media's Artist of the Month. The soulful, folksy Sioux City band joined Allie Carson in studio a private live recording session.
I'm Angie Lambrecht. I do vocals, guitar, and feet percussion.
I'm Randall Wood, and I'm playing the keys.
Sean Blomberg,
playing bass.
And I'm Adrian Colbo, and I play electric guitar.
Together, they are Ultraviolet.
It's not always seen, but it can always be felt.
Ultraviolet describes itself as an ever-evolving project, pushing the creative boundaries of self through musical expression. It started out as a duo with Angie and one of her best friends, Velvet Adams, on bass. Angie, a trained percussionist, was influenced by Shaky Graves, an Americana musician from Austin, Texas, who set out as a one-man band playing his vintage guitar and a drum made out of a suitcase.
It was really inspiring to be able to say, hey, I can play guitar, I can sing, and I can still play drums all at the same time.
Her DIY drum set includes three separate kick pedals attached to an old hard-side Samsonite suitcase, a floor-based tambourine, and another suitcase with a snare drum mounted in the center. Ultraviolet almost fell apart when Velvet moved away. Angie was the last woman standing. The 27-year-old singer-songwriter was getting close to following in her friend's footsteps and leaving Sioux City 2 when she met up with Sean and Adrian, who have known each other since they were kids.
So I was kind of out in the waters, not really knowing what the heck I was going to do, and these two guys were like, you know what, we can keep this project rolling, let's do it.
They introduced her to Randall, another longtime mutual friend. The new combo struck a chord.
She just radiates music. And so to really get to know her is to play music with her, I guess, and listen to her music as well.
I got a pocket full of mojo, and I got an ace in the hole. Now with the voice of an angel, I can make any man fall. And I got a pocket full of mojo, riding on some bag of bones. Can have you down on your knees, honey, making you scream at me.
There's a lot of tea.
We do drink a lot of tea.
I started out in rock and roll doing a lot of other harder harder beverages. And watch his eyes light up bright like the 4th of July.
Now watch him wiggle and giggle just like a wired child. Besides Angie, everyone in the band lived here and moved away to bigger cities like Montreal, Indianapolis, and Seattle. Then they came back in their early 30s and 40s.
That's part of the energy, too.
We have
too.
A love for this city, yeah. Actually. Yeah. Yeah. A lot of people are kind of like, we love Sioux City, so it's our city.
We've chosen to move back here and live here and make careers here. And yeah, of all the experiences that we've had in other cities and bands we've played with and musicians that we've collaborated with, this is right now is the place where we're supposed to be, and we've all chosen it, and it's really cool.
Definitely feels right.
It was weird that night when we met because we actually went to the same high school. We graduated, 7 years apart?
7, 8 years.
So we had like the same experience in high school growing up on the west side, going through the same band program with the same director. Mr. White. And we just had this like similar thing where when Sean and I saw her, we were like what they're doing is really cool. You know, Sean and I having moved away to find things that are really cool, it was really amazing to just walk into Vanguard and see this couple of women that were just rocking in on stage and find out what was going on with them, and then ultimately now we're in a band.
While some of their younger counterparts keep their eyes set on the big city, seeing it as the only place where dreams can come true, the members of Ultraviolet experienced a shift in perspective about the place they once called home.
I've been thinking about moving back for a long time. It had always been this thing in the back of my mind. You know, I have a big family here in Sioux City, and the goal is to be around my family and their kids and all of that. My dad got sick, and so it just kind of was the catalyst for that. And it helped me to jump ship and just say, I'm moving back. So, yeah, that was about 1.5 years ago. And
same for me. Family was the main inspiration. Also just tired of the big city and the rat race and feeling like I was spinning my wheels. And Randall and his wife, Christy, decided that they were going to make Sioux City their home. And we ended up kind of landing all at the same time, which is really cool. And it just made Sioux City feel like
I was the guy that left Sioux City and moved away to bigger cities thinking that that's where all the answers are found. If you move away, great, you know, go find what you got to find. But there's a lot of really amazing people in Sioux City that are making art and music. And for our size, it's really happening here.
That's Ultraviolet, Siouxland Public Media's Artist of the Month. To hear more from them and to listen to other local arts and culture features, visit kwit.org. For Siouxland Public Media, I'm Allie Carson.
Well, I stepped out my door today, and I felt the sun upon my shoulders. I heard the wind telling me that spring was on her way.
Take a walk with myself just so I could be as one.
That's it for this edition of The Exchange. Next week, we'll hear from Siouxland State lawmakers at a local forum where they'll take questions from constituents. Also, we'll learn about the history and cultural meaning of Native American powwows. That's next Wednesday at noon here on Siouxland Public Media. Thanks to Allie Carson, Mark Munger, Steve Smith, and Rick Turner. Coming up next on Siouxland Public Media, we'll go to Freakonomics Radio, or Freakonomics Hour. This is Siouxland Public Media, KWIT, Sioux City, 90.3, and KOJI Okoboji, 90.7. Broadcasting from the campus of Western Iowa Tech Community College, we'll see highs today in the upper 60s and then getting a lot colder over the next few days. Possibly some snow and rain in the forecast as well into late Thursday and early Friday. It's 1 o'clock and Freakonomics is coming up next. Stay tuned.